could only watch Kabuki in a warlord's mansion or something like that. And so many of the themes were focused on warriors. Even when Kabuki becomes popular among non-warriors, some of the themes remain. The heroes change. Now the hero is a regular, you know, citizen of Edo. But he still has the themes of loyalty, courage, martial valor, being able to beat people up, and those kinds of things. So another way to invent that the samurai are invented in the Tokugawa period is through the celebration of samurai values. And the other is also parody. There's a lot of literature, as you can learn from your many professors here, a lot of literature that mocks or makes fun of samurai, rural samurai, and their accents from different parts of Japan. This is one of Hokusai, who's famous for, you know, making the great wave woodblock print that you've all seen. But here's one of his lesser known prints called Privy. And here you can see from 1810, this was banned, of course, but you have the kind of higher-ranking samurai doing his business in the toilet, and his retainers, who are so loyal that they remain next to his toilet, covering their nose, never, you know, shirking their duty, which was Hokusai's way to critique, you know, some of the samurai values. And this, of course, is why it was banned. It's also a political critique, right? So whether it's through celebration, whether it's through collecting, whether it's through parody, the samurai are constantly being invented and reinvented in the Tokugawa period. But of these many genres of warrior culture, that is to say culture about warriors and warrior values, for me, one of the most important is swordsmanship. Because swordsmanship is a way for understanding how activists during the Meiji Restoration become activists. Because through swordsmanship, they're able to close the gap between samurai reality. Samurai were mostly poor, disaffected, underemployed, unmarried men. Most of the rank and file samurai. Close the gap between that reality and warrior fantasy. You know, the ideal warrior depicted in these various genres of culture where, you know, loyalty, duty, self-sacrifice, and courage are being celebrated, right? So if you're a low-ranking samurai and you have a job that doesn't fully employ you, and of course some of you might have read Musui's story, an autobiography of a 19th century samurai. He talks about, you know, how he used to go out begging and sell swords. So how do you close the gap between your everyday reality as a samurai and all the things that you're being taught when you're a young samurai? Your education, the kabuki you watch, the literature, the military science books you have to read, many of which are Chinese in origin, right, which is another side to this. So what happens is, on one hand, the most violent of the zealots, or the activists, during the Meiji Restoration, what they do is they over-identify with the fantasy. They take the samurai fantasy all too seriously, and thus undermine the warrior regime, regardless of whose side they are. I mean, after all, most of the daimyo, the warlords who are in charge, don't want their young samurai to be activists. You know, they're trying to rein them in, not tell them to go out and kill foreigners and hunt down people from the Tokugawa shogunate. On the other hand, commoners appropriate warrior culture in their own ways, which undermines the symbolic power of the warriors and the warrior regime. This is important because, as Slavoj Žižek has shown, symbolic power is effective only when it is virtual. When there is the promise or the threat of power. Once the warrior regime, in this case, no longer monopolizes that symbolic power, its authority is rendered impotent. And that's, in fact, what happens. You see more commoners participating in warrior culture, even in swordsmanship. And they often join bands of activists, samurai activists. So one of the questions we have about swordsmanship, then, is what is swordsmanship? It began, I argue, as a field of knowledge in the 17th century. Swordsmanship was, to borrow a phrase from Pierre Bourdieu, an activity with no purpose. That is to say, it had no productive material function. It was not done for material gain. It was not done to become number one at a sport, initially. Nor was it even studied for its putative instrumentalist reasons. That is to say, studying swordsmanship was not an effective way to learn how to do combat. And the proof of this is in the pudding. There are no schools of swordsmanship during the Warring States period. It's only during the 17th century, when war is over, that there are schools of swordsmanship. In fact, for warrior elites, and we should understand that samurai are not all one big group. Most people are lower ranking samurai than their higher ranking samurai, etc. For warrior elites, becoming a teacher of swordsmanship was seen as beneath them. And throughout the Tokugawa period, only the lowest ranking samurai, or maybe some more famous schools, would have a mid-level samurai who became teachers. And indeed, the same kind of phenomena exists in Europe as well. King James I told his son, you should practice the physical arts, quote, but don't make a craft of them, right? So there's this kind of elite disinterest towards the physical arts. While swordsmanship had no purpose, it did have meaning, and there's a difference here. Among warriors, swordsmanship was an embodiment of their supposed martial identity, which was being invented throughout the Tokugawa period, when, for the first time, samurai became a relatively strict-defined group, sas group in Japanese history. Unlike other forms of martial and warrior culture being invented through literature, theater, military history writing, swordsmanship was physical, was a physical participant-centered activity. This too occurred elsewhere in the early modern world. For example, Robert Nye points to the popularity of honor dueling and masculinity in early modern France by invoking Pierre Bourdieu. Quote, the body believes in what it plays at. It weeps if it mimes grief. It does not represent what it performs. It enacts the past, bringing it back to life. So swordsmanship acts as a kind of social and cultural capital, to use the theoretical terms, for elite samurai to interact with each other and to pretend to be the kind of warriors that their predecessors were in the 15th and 16th century, without actually being endangered in the practice of swordsmanship itself. In fact, swordsmanship, so if we look at examples of symbolic and cultural value, to this day you can still buy, even on Yahoo Auction, which is Japan's version of eBay. They don't have eBay. They have Japan Yahoo Auction. And you can buy these certificates of rank and of expertise. Simply possessing these was enough. Most people didn't read them or understand what they said. You just possessed them. And this was not only for swordsmanship, but for cooking schools, for tea ceremony, for poetry schools, etc. And they were also often collected for their artistic value as well. These were usually written and illustrated by a specialist, not by a teacher of swordsmanship itself. But swordsmanship became the primary site of discrimination among samurai. In certain domains, for example, in Kawagoe domain, there were certain schools of swordsmanship that were officially sanctioned, and a teacher would receive a stipend to teach. His students would receive stipends to actually study the art of swordsmanship. They would receive extra money for equipment and this kind of thing. While the unofficial schools were studied by low-ranking samurai who did not receive money for buying equipment, did not receive money for teaching, etc. So even within swordsmanship themselves, there's a discrimination among samurai. And interestingly, the lack of status, that is to say the lack of a certain rank in the warrior regime, could impede your advancement in certain schools of swordsmanship and other things. One example is the daimyo, that is to say the warlord of the Kawagoe domain, sent one of his lower-ranking samurai to bring back Shindenryu, a style of swimming, because swimming was also considered a martial art, right? Go to this neighboring domain and bring back those teachings so you can teach it here. He goes to the other domain, studies swimming, gets to the point where he's going to get a license of full mastery, but because he's not the right rank in that domain, he's not given it, so he has to go back to the original domain where they temporarily promote him in status so he can go back get the certificate, come back and teach, right? So this is one of the things that happens within swordsmanship. Now, this is not simply an activity among samurai or even in the castle towns where most of the samurai lived. There was what's called the century of rural swordsmen. And this begins around the 1720s and 1730s when landed samurai were allowed to carry swords like a regular samurai and use surnames. Landed samurai were typically commoners who claimed to be descended from warriors of the Warring States period. Oftentimes those claims were completely false. You could simply make it up, make up a lineage. Yeah, sure, my dad fought with Hideyoshi, etc., great-great-granddad. And so those people who are typically the elites, they served as village headmen or vice mayors or something like that, they were given this status, goshi, or landed samurai, and allowed to carry swords. So what happened was, that these rural elites and rural entrepreneurs who had pushed economic development with the acceptance and even encouragement from the domain that they lived in, and the domains of course wanted more tax from the productivity, were also given these titles. And simply being able to carry swords was not enough. The idea was that you should learn how to use it, right? You're in a physical activity with other commoner elites who are given this temporary, semi-temporary status, and you want to kind of show off or prove that you are samurai in that embodiment of swordsmanship, you know, that Bjorn Bjordeutu talks about. Now, let's see, in the interest of time, we'll skip ahead of that. Let's see. Now, commoners actively developed the changes in swordsmanship. There was never any sense in the early part of the Tokugawa period of fencing. That is to say, there was no free-form practice of swordsmanship. That's something that really starts in the 18th century among low-ranking samurai and rural and urban commoners. They begin to develop equipment, and this is done for several reasons. One, it's done as a form of betting. Swordsmanship and fencing were also practiced in rural festivals. They were also done as a form of weather prediction. You would train in kata, and where you'd have a fencing match, and whichever team won would determine what the weather for the crops would be like. So you have all of these other appropriations of swordsmanship in the countryside among non-samurai, which was totally not the intention of the swordsmanship phenomenon in the 17th century. And some of these rural elites even become famous in the Tokugawa shogunate. One particular school of swordsmanship that I study about called Nenryu, there was a commoner who was in his 90s who demonstrated swordsmanship for one of the senior advisors in the shogunate. And this senior advisor, in fact, writes about this guy, Higuchi, and says, you know, he's really a master at swordsmanship. So there's even a kind of subtle approval of commoners doing swordsmanship in certain ways. By and large, however, most commoners were absolutely forbidden from studying swordsmanship. And the reason was, are several. One of them is that it's not their status, right? The idea based in Chinese thought, Confucianism or Neo-Confucianism, if you will, was that everyone is in their own status and should be doing the things that they're born into. The very first edict issued by the Tokugawa shogunate is in 1804 that says, each of the four statuses has a separate occupation, but recently people have been setting up training areas in their houses or adding them to their houses and teaching non-samurai and townsmen martial arts. This is not a proper art for those of commoner status, and they might lose their occupations. So the fear was that in doing swordsmanship and archery, you weren't farming, which is what you were supposed to do from the point of view of the shogunate. Moreover, so it's not just about productivity, moreover, this is seen as insolence, furaci, right? If one hears of such an activity, report it to an official. The practice of martial arts by townsmen is strictly forbidden. Of course, this did not at all stop the trend of commoners doing swordsmanship, because what happens is a lot of low-ranking samurai, who again have little recourse to earning money outside of whatever horrible job they have for their local domain, is they become teachers to commoners, wealthy commoners and rural elites who are willing to pay to learn swordsmanship. And there's another issue, especially in the Kanto Plain, which is around the city of Edo. In the mid-19th century, there are more what are called uchikawashi, smashings, and other kind of riots. There's rural violence. And the shogunate, although they have a kind of police force of sorts, they're overextended. So what they begin to do in the mid-19th century is ask village headmen to create militias, create local police of a sort. That's the term I use, police, or something like that. And of course, these commoners say, well, great, we'll help you police the countryside, but you have to allow us to study swordsmanship and grappling and staff fighting and these kinds of things. And essentially, the shogunate is stuck, so they allow them to do that. And in practicing swordsmanship, these commoners are not simply doing this for a physical activity, and most of them would not be, you know, trying to cut down a criminal or something like that. But there's this sense that they are part of the warrior regime by extension, helping police the countryside, and thus are culturally also part of the value system, for lack of a better term, that the warrior regime is trying to encourage. And that's where we kind of see the impotence of the regime, that they ultimately have to rely on commoners a lot, right? So they give up that virtual power a little bit. This was not only among rural mayors and stuff like that. Even at Issei Shrine, once Perry and more Westerners arrive in the mid-19th century, the shogunate wants to encourage coastal defenses, and part of increasing your coastal defense is to have more people training in martial arts. At least that's how some daimyo see it. So the Yamada magistrate, which is the magistrate in charge of protecting the Issei Shrine, which is the Shinto shrine connected to the imperial family, allowed Shinto priests to practice swordsmanship. In 1853, the Yamada magistrate wrote to the Issei Shrine representatives telling them, although it is not good for you to learn warrior customs, buke no fugi, seeing as you're already allowed to carry swords as a privilege, we will allow you to practice swordsmanship to the extent that it does not interfere with the jobs of your status. As for those teaching swordsmanship, they should not harbor ronin, masterless samurai, or other sorts. As the shogunate was more concerned with criminal behavior than the accompanying status issues and status ambiguity. After an 1855 inspection of the Issei Shrine, however, officials from Edo felt that the shrine was not sufficiently protected. Priests were ordered to survey temple bells that could be melted down for the use in cannon and rifles, kind of a precursor to World War II, and to start training in martial arts, especially gunnery. So something that had been happening is a lot of these sword arts kind of die out as gunnery, and the use of cannon becomes more important in the Meiji Restoration. And that too applies to commoners. And there's a formation of peasant militias around the Kanto Plain training in gunnery in the 19th century. Despite continued edicts against commoners practicing swordsmanship, and we see the edict being released first in 1805, then in 1814, 1830, so the shogunate on one hand is repeatedly saying to commoners, you should not be practicing swordsmanship. On the other hand, it is telling certain commoners, you should be practicing swordsmanship. And this is kind of this is another thing that we should think about when we think about the shogunate. The shogunate is not a monolith where everyone agrees and stamps the paperwork. There are different factions and different things going on all the time. By the 1860s, the shogunate relied upon royal elites to organize and train peasant militias. In 1862, it encouraged the bannermen, that is to say, hatamoto, high-ranking samurai, to recruit peasants to form militias. Rural elite swordsmen, of course, also filled the ranks of various vigilante groups, such as the Shinsengumi, which some of the students might know through anime, manga, etc. And they were fighting along samurai, so they were not just doing this for self-protection, not simply for gambling or for festivals, but they really believed it. You know, they over-identify with the cause of the ideal warrior who's dying for, you know, some greater cause. For commoners who participated in the Meiji Restoration, swordsmanship became a vehicle for living out their martial ideals, a motivation that coincided with their desire to be taken seriously as politically active participants in the Meiji Restoration. One Japanese scholar has argued that these types of commoners felt an akogare, right, an affection for the bushi, the samurai status group, and felt patriotism through their practice and teaching of sword arts. What's interesting to note here is that what often happens is the kind of elite sword styles that were popular in the 17th century, several domains fire those teachers and hire teachers of the newer fencing styles, which was often taught by commoners. So now you have commoners teaching swordsmanship to samurai in the mid-19th century, which totally throws everything out of order. Now, of course, some of this breaks down into other issues. A lot of samurai, a lot of the people who are politically active, who are samurai in the 19th century, are low-ranking samurai who are told to go travel by their domains. You know, we don't have any jobs for you. The samurai say, well, can I go to Edo to study, you know, literature or nativism or poetry or swordsmanship? And so you also have this trend of traveling to train. They would go to different schools and train with other people, record who they had matches with. And there was even an issue of celebrity status, you know, similar to sumo wrestlers today who will put their handprints as their signature. So too you have that in the Tokugawa period with sword practitioners. You also have a kind of religious side to this, dedication plaques, hogaku I think is the Japanese, and you'll still see these in Japanese shrines and temples in the countryside. People giving demonstrations to the kami, right, to the gods at a shrine, and then we'll put up a plaque. And the interesting thing that happens here, in kind of in the detailed research that I've done, is that there will be, these are essentially similar to gang tagging. So if one style of swordsmanship puts a plaque up and another style of swordsman tries to come to that shrine and put up a plaque, they can actually break out into fighting. You know, this is our territory, you don't get into our territory. And there, Takizawa Bakin, who's the famous literature guy, is it Bakin? He writes this short story about the Nenryu style swordsmanship, where a guy named Honma Sengoro pretends like he's a general and sits atop a barrel and directs his all commoner students, he is also a commoner, you know, to fill in the inns at Ikoho so no practitioners of a rival sword status can come in and go to the shrine and do a dedication. So this kind of thing. Again, an example of prohibitions against chonin. Now what happens after the Meiji Restoration, of course, is that swordsmanship goes into decline, in part because the whole warrior, not simply the warrior status in the concrete sense of it being a status, not only does that fall apart, but also the whole warrior ideals temporarily also go into decline immediately after the Meiji Restoration among a lot of people. You know, the samurai are seen as this backwards feudal thing that's an embarrassment. And so the only way it survives are things like spectacle performances, you know, having women with halberds in short skirts fight against men with swords or something like this. But even then, there still is a kind of political edge to swordsmanship. in the freedom and people's rights movement, which some of you might have studied if you do modern Japanese history. The most politically active region for the freedom and people's rights movement outside of Edo proper is in the Tama region, where swordsmanship was extremely popular among commoners, and many of the commoner or former commoners, or still commoners, so not ex-samurai participants, but commoner participants, were themselves teachers of swordsmanship or practitioners of swordsmanship, and they also became politically active during the people's rights movement. One of the organizers of the freedom and people's rights movement made both his wife and daughter train in the halberd, for example, even though it has no function anymore. You know, you're not going to go kill people, maybe, during a protest. But nonetheless, this idea that you can be loyal and active is not something that you do just for a daimyo, but it connects to politics, that you're loyal to a cause, which kind of shows a point that I'd like to end on by Alain Badiou, who says, those who have nothing, the poor, sometimes only have their discipline. The poor, those with no financial or military means, those with no power, all they have is their capacity to act together. And this discipline is already a form of political organization. And so what I would end with is, although we think of swordsmanship and connect it to the nationalism or the kind of imperial, emperor-centered nationalism of the Meiji period, it's also open to leftists. That this also becomes a site for their organizing as well, even though that eventually disappears. So I will end there. Many other things to say, but I will end there and allow you to ask questions. Thank you very much.
Well, I have a really simple question, perhaps.
Yes.
What's the difference between fencing and swordsmanship?
Right, so swordsmanship is when you have both, you have two people and they're doing kata, right? So they're doing a prearranged, you know, one person does this move, the other person reacts this way. And in swordsmanship, for most of the Tokugawa period, that's how swordsmanship was done. It was actually forbidden to have matches, because matches could lead to, you know, hey, I won, who won, and that turns into a fight, and there's this kenka ryosebai, right, in the Edo period. If you get into a fight, both people get punished. So having a match within your own school was forbidden, and having matches with other schools was also forbidden, because that can be a site of rivalry and cross-domain tensions. But that also kind of disappears in the 19th century as these low-ranking samurai and commoners who are not under the thumb of the shogunate as much, kind of on their own, say, well, maybe we should do fencing and let's put these bamboo swords together, and they do this on their own because they're free from the confines of their local domain. And so there you get, you know, this wearing of armor and engaging in just free sparring, as it were, the actual fencing. That's how I distinguish the two.
So the swordsmanship is more like, you said there's two people that are doing one kata, basically.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's what I would call swordsmanship.
So dancing.
I mean, some have said that, yes. In fact, in the 17th century, I think it's Ogyu Sorai and some others who say, you know, the swordsmanship today is simply a flowery, is a flowery method or flowery swordsmanship, you know. Others would argue that's misinterpreting it, but there is, already in the 17th century, there's this criticism of this is nothing like the Warring States period. And what's great is in the 17th century, you have people saying in the Warring States period there were no martial arts, there was just fighting on the battlefield. You know, they literally say that, which is great for my argument. Sure. Yes?
I was very interested in all the ways in which I didn't realize that Japanese decided to cross these boundaries dealing with the commoners. I didn't think commoners would be allowed to do this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. But also interesting that crossover between art and practicality.
Yes.
So like this stuff that you do that has some use, and yet when you want people to defend the coastline, you want them to learn it.
Yes.
And it obviously has no use. And so,
right.
It made me think of things like martial arts, which seems to take on also, like people take martial arts to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, whether or not people actually on the street, when they're attacked, turn into martial arts.
Yeah, exactly.
Except in movies, right?
Right.
So it's a discipline rather than a or a status thing. And so I was wondering if this is, when they said, why don't you learn sword play for defend the coastline, did they really mean that? Or was that just a way of kind of population control in some way, disciplining the population?
Right, so what happens is, when they say learn swordsmanship, most domains are